Welcome to Beneath Your Beautiful, where guests share stories of adversity and perseverance, which inspire, encourage, and challenge us. We embrace these tough conversations, intimately exploring our loves, fears, and hopes with a delicious combination of depth and lightness.
Hi, I'm Edie Nathan, and I work with grief and loss and trauma and burnout and sexual grief. And the way that I look at all of it is that it is like a hero's journey. And the depths of our losses, and they are many, not just the loss of a loved one, takes us into the metaphorical cave where we must battle with our shadows. And the shadows are the parts of us that we don't want to tangle with or look at, whether it's our loneliness or our regrets or our shame or our loss. And I see grief as being broken down into a non-linear phase or phases, of which I see that there are 11, but there's no order necessarily to how one grieves, and there's no right or wrong. It just takes the path of kind of like the fingerprint. It's as individual as you are.
Mm-hmm. Is it Elizabeth Kubler-Ross? Is her stages of grief something you agree about or disagree?
When she initially developed the stages of grief, they were actually developed for the people who were dying. And she wrote it specifically for people who were dying. David Kessler, who has expanded her work, now does talk about the six stages of grief. I don't see grief as moving between a beginning, a middle, and an end of every stage. That doesn't mean it can't inform us.
Mm-hmm.
I prefer to think of the phases, so it's not disagree or agree, but in addition to.
How did you get here? Have you suffered yourself and then figured a way out?
So I have had a fair amount of losses, the loss of my first partner, and he was really a major love in my life and taught me about love, but also surviving having been bullied and having been extremely overweight and just chastised by my peers. Those are losses, and those bring grief in different ways. And sexual abuse is part of that. So I would say that I come to this because of my own personal stories, but also because I was pretty young when everything was going down, and I was 27 when I lost my partner. And I think that there was no one to turn to, you know, there was no one to say, hey, I could use some help here. The messaging I got was, you're young and don't worry, you'll find another love, you'll find another partner. And that was really not an answer. And I realized, okay, you know, there's a hole here. And what I also realized is that by going through Paul's death, that the things that I had not dealt with, my own traumas, historic traumas, had never really, really been dealt with. So his death brought up a whole flowery, gorgeous arrangement of traumas that needed to be taken into the cave and looked at.
And how did you get started with that? Because we know it's kind of scary to take it out and look at it. And I know that if you don't, it just is always there. So, but how did you get started? What was something you did to start your healing process?
I'm a big reader and researcher, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I just started to do a lot of reading. I happened to be in school getting a master's degree at the time. And I was going into corporate training. I had been an actor, and I said, okay, well, I'm not going to do this acting thing, but maybe I'll become a corporate trainer. And then when Paul died, it changed the entire trajectory of my life. And what evolved was a realization of, wow, I can go in and I can help families who are dealing with loved ones who are dying. I can see where there is grief kind of everywhere, and that we need to find, what I wrote my initial thesis on was creative techniques to help people grieve. And so it went into the idea of storytelling as part of a way to heal. and it went into puppetry and it went into mask making, and that there were these quote unquote projective techniques. I became a drama therapist and a psychodramatist, ways to enact the grief and the loss so that it was not like stale, but it actually had movement to it. And that movement actually kind of broke up the concrete of grief that was within me and helped me to see that I could create a different mosaic. And you said something a little bit earlier, and I know that we're early in our conversation about, you know, kind of healing from it. You know, we heal, but we don't forget.
Right.
And it's not something that I believe that we get over. I believe we dance with it. I believe we partner with it. And I know the metaphor of dance is a strange metaphor to use, like who wants to dance with their grief? And yet it is getting to know that partner, getting to know the moves they make on holidays, the moves they make when, you know, maybe you're out there dating for the first time, the moves that they make when you run into the person who teased you or bullied you. And how do you dance with it when it does come up so that it's not a stranger, but rather a partner?
I really love that. I have been saying that we're on the other side of our traumas, and somebody corrected me that that's just too hard to get to. And I really like that that was brought to my attention, that we're never on the other side of it exactly. It's always there.
It is.
So I really appreciate that. And I appreciate the analogy that we're dancing with it, because I am not the story that my mother died when I was young anymore, but it's still true. And I still think about her all the time. I'm still a little girl longing a little bit for her.
Good.
That doesn't change. And that's what I like about what you're saying about that grief is always there, and that's okay. And actually, I'm so happy that I always have my mother. It's not as painful as it once was, but I always want that grief to be there. I always want to miss her. I want to talk about her. I want to love her. I want to think about her. So I appreciate that it's brought to my attention that we don't get over it and not necessarily rise above it, but dance with it is beautiful. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for your story. I just actually just returned a few days ago from Africa and had a chance to go on some safaris and really watch and observe the animals in the wild. And this may sound like a far reach, but the impala is kind of likened to our deer. There are many all over the wilds of these countries that I was in. And they are the most hunted because there are so many. They travel in herds. You know, there's a good chance that one of them every night is going to be taken away. And what you saw in them was like a jitteriness, a jumpiness, a looking around, the eyes that were always darting. And that is like being in trauma all of the time. And I don't know that they really feel grief per se. There's a lot of reproduction that occurs, but certainly there is something inbred within them that is like a startle and a stark reality of danger lurking all of the time, juxtaposed to the lions and the cheetahs who have a confidence about them and do not have darting eyes. They're actually smooth jewels. You know, they carry themselves in such a way as to just kind of say, I'm here and it's going to be hard to shake me. And I think that grief and trauma kind of carries both. The lions had the scars of big fights, but the impalas carried their anxiety. And that's us. If you've been traumatized and you've had trauma because of grief or because of the loss of a loved one, the loss of a limb or sexual grief, which is like forming a kinship with a sexually traumatic event over one's developmental time on this earth, you move with it in such a way that it evokes a need to protect yourself and a need to always know where the danger is.
We are simultaneously the impala and the lion.
Yeah.
Yeah. I like when I'm in the lion state better.
Who doesn't? I do too.
I feel more lioness than I ever have, which is nice.
It is nice.
I know plenty of people who are sure danger is right around the corner and that something bad's going to happen because something bad hasn't happened in a minute. How do you help those people?
Perhaps the first question is what's holding them hostage. Because part of, I think, an ongoing new perspective that I've been ascribing to is that we are often held hostage by our traumas and by our grief. You said something to let me know that you're not being held hostage, as you're no longer just identifying as the young child who lost her mother way too young, and that that is a part of you. It is not all of you.
Mm-hmm.
Thinking that it is all of you is what keeps you held hostage. And so I want to help people become hostage negotiators with the things that keep them held hostage. And I call them the hostage takers. And so we must learn to negotiate with our hostage takers. And the first step, the first true tasks of that is to learn to listen. And what we don't want to do often is to listen. We need to engage, because any good hostage negotiator with the hostage taker will say, I want to hear your story. I want to know why you needed to take that person or that animal hostage. Let me hear it. Let me understand it so that I can let you know that I care about your story, and I'm going to hear it. I'm going to listen. Because if you were to go to any movie where someone's been taken hostage, the hostage taker wants something. They want medicine for their loved one. They want money in the bank so they can have a sex change operation. They want something.
Mm-hmm.
So what does your hostage taker want?
I was, for a very long time, the story I was telling myself. And now, obviously, I can say that is just a thing that happened to me. It is not the thing. It is not me. Is that what you're helping people do?
You've asked the question now twice in the same way, like, how do you help people? And I realize I'm not answering it. And maybe because when I land in my virtual room with people or I'm speaking to a large group, it's about them.
Maybe you are answering it and I'm not hearing you because I'm expecting a different answer. Because what you said about the hostage taker and negotiator makes sense to me. I don't know why I keep asking the same question. So maybe you did answer it. That is a beautiful way to help people. So maybe I'm wrong to keep asking the same question.
It's not wrong. I think the clarification is really important.
Mm-hmm.
This is not about wrong, I think, because we want to know, so how are you going to help? What are you going to do? That is the question.
Mm-hmm.
When someone enters therapy, when they call their beloved priest or rabbi or someone who they care about, a friend or someone who is learned, it's like, how can I help? How can they be of service to mend you, to heal you? And I guess what I want to know is, what are you yearning for? What do you want? Because I am only going to be as good as you are. And what I know is that the hostage taker's in the room. And unless we start to listen and take apart the hostage taker, that we're not going to be able to do the kind of work that needs to get done.
Is there a common theme with the people that you help? Or is it more like a fingerprint? Every single person is different because we come to everything differently.
We do. We come to everything differently. You know, your story is going to be different than mine, different than, you know, your next door neighbors. That doesn't mean there aren't themes, but even within the theme that's presented, it's colored by so many different accents and forests and kingdoms. You have a mother, and let's say you had a birth mother who gave you up, and you have an idea of who that birth mother was or is, and then you meet the birth mother and she doesn't fit the bill. And so not only is the hope that you're going to construct this mother-child relationship with the mother who gave you up, and now you can, it's another loss. And so, you know, we can keep constructing what we believe will heal us or what informs the grief that someone is walking in with or the trauma that someone is walking in with, but there are many layers and it is a mosaic.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that the goal of the therapy is to figure out what is the mosaic and what part of the mosaic's been broken and how do we build it and how do we restructure it.
Thank you. How do people work with you? Is it all online?
It's all online, and hopefully I'm going to be putting together some kind of a webinar so that I can really help more people and get the 11 phases out there and give them monthly structures that they can work with and work around. And my website is just full, chock full of blogs and information on grief, on loss, on trauma. My first book is It's Grief, The Dance of Self-Discovery Through Trauma and Loss. And I'm in the process right now of finishing the first draft of a second book on sexual grief. I don't have even a title for it, but right now I'm calling it Sexual Grief, A Human Condition, because I don't think any of us really escape it. I think it affects us. And with that said, I think that the one-on-one work is wonderful. My goal is to be able to help more people rather than just one-on-one. So though I've got a practice, I'm seeing fewer people so that I can actually do a greater outreach for all people. Because this work is not just for women and it is not just for men. It is for they, it is for all people. One of my favorite stories is The Wizard of Oz. And I see The Wizard of Oz as a true metaphor for what goes on in the cave of the hero's journey. And it is when the Wicked Witch is killed by Dorothy's house and the good, quote unquote, good witch, you know, bestows her with these beautiful red shoes. And then she must meet the Scarecrow and the Tin Man and the Lion. And she must meet really the parts of herself that have not been developed. And so part of what I encourage everyone to think about is how do they meet their heart? And how do they meet their courage? And how do they meet their brains? And that they carry with them more than they realize. And they have those metaphorical red shoes. And that the wizard, though behind a shield, looks like he's strong and powerful, is really just a little man behind a screen. And that sometimes our most horrible voices, the ones that keep us down, the judges and the critics, are behind that screen. And that if we can take them into our caves and face off with them and help them see that we've got courage and we've got a heart and we've got our brains and that we can walk with our grief and our loss. And it doesn't mean that we lose anything, but actually we gain some part of ourselves. That is such an important part of how to move with our losses and our grief and our trauma, is to know what you have and walk with it.
That's so beautiful. We have the power within us. We always have it. And so is that, there's no place like home. She could have just clicked her heels the whole time.
Oh gosh. No, she couldn't have. She had to learn that she could do it. But before meeting the different parts of herself that needed to be developed, she wouldn't have had the ability to handle the power of the clicking the three times.
I don't know why that choked me up.
It chokes me up.
That's so beautiful. My 27-year-old daughter does a lot of work and yet, you know, she still struggles. And I have a piece that she doesn't have and I want it for her, but I see that she still needs the journey. I can't just bestow it on her. That really helped me understand it. Thank you.
You're welcome. As much as we want to give to the people we love, we want to give them the path. I know with me, and it sounds like for you, nobody can give you the path. You've got to find it.
You can't learn from anybody else's mistakes. Otherwise, nobody would ever make a mistake.
And we live in a world where it's harder and harder to come back from our mistakes. And so instead of taking chances and doing dares, there's a lot of let's play it safe. And the pandemic hasn't helped. You know, I mean, we're living in en masse. I see your tears, by the way. And thank you for sharing them.
You're welcome.
We're a grieving world for a variety of different reasons. 6 degrees of separation in terms of the losses that we incurred because of the pandemic, not only like the loss of life, and trust me, I'm in no way like saying that that is not so important and so intense, the losses of the lives, but the loss of the senses of self, the part of who you thought you were and who you realized you weren't. And that may be living alone in a 300 square foot apartment in any of your larger cities was harder than you thought. And even though the first 2 weeks was like, oh, gee, I can work from home. This is pretty cool. Eventually, it took its toll. It took its toll on socialization. It took its toll on the experimentation for our teenagers of going out and dating and falling in love and having a first kiss and having that first kiss not go so well, perhaps, and learning how to cope and deal, that so much got truncated. Our development got truncated, whether it's because of aging and not being able to say goodbye to a parent who was in a long-term care facility, or the child who couldn't go on their developmental ride that they need in order to know how to flirt, how to smell somebody, how to be in the throes of a true flush of the skin, those intimate moments, or the rubbing of shoulders in a classroom, or the insider joke. I mean, things became so much harder for so many. And we're going to have mental health issues. And sadly, you know, there's the suicidality is high right now. Re-entry is really, really hard, and trying to figure out our paths and trying to figure out where are my brains and where is my heart and where is my courage and how do I own my red shoes? It's all over the world.
I don't know why it's so emotional, the ruby red slippers. I don't know. I've liked the show, but never really thought about it as a journey. So I love that.
Yeah.
This has been obviously very emotional, but very beautiful. And I really appreciate the conversation.
I appreciated the conversation. And thank you for your sensitivity in just staying with it.
Thank you. I'm so glad we had this conversation. I truly feel like this was supposed to happen this day. And I was supposed to hear exactly what you had to say at this moment, and really, really touched me. And I appreciate your sensitivity. And I just really enjoy chatting with you. And I'm sure you help many just by how you tell the stories.
It's all in the stories, because that's how I see us. We are walking stories.
Well, we are. It's such a freedom when we can retell it, not rewrite it because it happened to us, but to retell it in a way that serves us.
Yes, to retell it in the way it serves us. Beautiful. I love it.
Thank you for joining us for this week's episode of Beneath Your Beautiful, hosted by Hara Allison. And thank you for your ratings and reviews. We'll be back next week with a new episode. Stay tuned.